Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have five matters on our calendar today, and we have the lawyers for the second case in front of us. So I will ask the marshal to call the second case.
Case number A21-1498 in the matter of the welfare of the children of SBHL and WAT parents.
All right, and counsel, good morning. I'm going to make just a few quick remarks before we proceed with the argument. You can tell that we are proceeding by Zoom today. So this matter is also recorded. An audio recording will be available on the court's website. That's the only recording that is allowed. Because our record does include the audio recording, our record is made of the audio recording for today's argument, I would like to remind counsel to do a couple of things. First of all, when you start your remarks, please identify yourself as well as the client that you represent clearly so it's on the record. And then secondly, just the clock should be visible to you on your screen, and we want to make sure that if it isn't, you certainly say something. Again, you have instructions about also if you were to lose connectivity, you know what to do there. But as to the clock, our time goes quickly. We really appreciate getting this chance to hear from you. And so keep an eye on the clock as you proceed with your argument. So with that, we are ready for counsel for appellant, and you can begin when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors, opposing counsel, and may it please the court. My name is Michelle Olson, and I represent the appellant WAT in this matter. Just procedurally, there have been some issues with this case, which is part of our concerns with the ineffective assistance of counsel and just how this matter was handled overall. As the court is aware, my client had not received proper notice of when he was to appeal. He found out later that he was out of time, and not only was he out of time for an appeal, but to do any post-trial motions. So procedurally, he could not have made arguments for ineffective assistance of counsel to district court, as well as this is the only opportunity for him to have that chance because his counsel didn't provide the documents, as well as district court and the court administrator did not follow the rules of the Minnesota juvenile procedure. But really,
again,
at the heart
of you, counsel, just to clarify, when you say didn't follow the rules, you're talking about the notice, right?
Yes, sir.
Which, as I see, and I, you know, please, I think what you're going to is why your record on the ineffective assistance of counsel is what it is. And if that's true, you know, go right ahead with your argument. On the other hand, it seems to me with the Supreme Court's order directing us to allow this appeal to proceed, most of the procedural error has been corrected, right?
You are correct that my argument and the reason why we have such little evidence and little record of what happened is because my client lost his opportunity to go forward. And he almost lost his opportunity to appeal, but for the fact that the Supreme Court said, no, he is entitled to it because the notice requirement and the procedural defects there allowed for it. But I think the issue with that is part of the rules say we need to have effective assistance of counsel. We need to make sure that counsel remains on throughout the appeal period to ensure that you don't lose your rights. And that is an ineffective assistance of counsel when counsel is aware that there's post-trial motions that are could be laid out before the court. And then all of a sudden, they are not told. He has no notice of what he can do or can't do. So it's a compound issue. It's not just the attorney, but the fact that the attorney is an experienced attorney who is aware of these procedural issues and did not inform him of them and did not even note that that notice was missing as it's part of the rules and didn't do due diligence is an additional problem that has led to where we are today. But going back to really the heart of the matter, which is my client loves his children, wants to be in his children, and desperately would have done anything to be allowed to have them. And instead of what was I'll agree, not a great situation, the behavior was not appropriate, does not mean that he should lose his children or his rights to his children forever. That is not the standard that has ever been presented before the court, and it continues to not be the standard. And unfortunately,
counsel, if you don't mind, when you say that is not the standard, what are you referring to? Are you saying the district court applied the wrong standard in making the termination decision? I didn't see that in your brief, but maybe I'm misunderstanding.
What I'm saying is the district court failed to make appropriate findings under the rules that would allow for the termination of the parental rights. It's not merely just finding the statutory ground potentially for it and weighing the best interest. There are three primary factors that must be discussed and not just say, well, this led to this, therefore we can't, we have found for this one factor or found for this factor. There has to be enough analysis to truly understand why a person should have their rights terminated. Because again, we all agree that it is a constitutional right to be able to rear your children, and we have to weigh those process. And while the children's interests are paramount, and there is no disagreement in that, the district court's findings do not really effectively explain why those three balancing tests were not met. Regarding the children's relationship and their desire to have a relationship with their father, there is a lot of summarizing of testimony, and there's no real analysis of that testimony equating to the children not wanting to see their father. What seems to be mentioned within the findings is the children got quiet when mentioned to them they might not see their father again.
So, counsel, you know, looking at the guardian ad litem's testimony about the children's response, it's not just a single incident of the children being quiet, but 4 to 5 visits, I believe, by the guardian ad litem in which the pending, you know, petition for termination of parental rights was discussed, and for which the children, according to the guardian ad litem, showed no interest in the relationship. You know, expressed no interest. Now, if I were just looking at that one piece of evidence in isolation, I would be, you know, perhaps moving in your direction or at least asking some of those questions. But it isn't just that piece of evidence. There's a lot more here about father's relationship with the children. And it isn't, you know, I think you characterized it early on as not a great situation. And I see a couple of references in your brief that appear to minimize the district court's findings about father's conduct with his children, which includes beating the children, and that there are recordings of those beatings, physical beatings and assaults on the children. So, you know, in light of that, I think that the children's silence is a significant piece of evidence with respect to their interest in maintaining a relationship with father. So, you know, help me understand, I'm not, of course you disagree with my take on the evidence, but it's not my take. It's the district court's take on the evidence. So tell me why, when all of the evidence is viewed correctly, how the district court made a legal error or an abuse of discretion in its analysis of the best interests of these children.
Of course, Your Honor. Just to note for the record, my understanding of the situation where there were 4 or 5 visits, but there was only one instance in which it was specifically discussed that they may not see their father again. And at that point, the children became quiet. So my understanding of what happened was there was only one instance where it got brought up. And when it got brought up, the children were quiet. And there's no discussion by the district court of what being quiet would mean. I agree with you.
Counsel, if you would move on, though, please, to analyze this in light of all of the evidence in the record, because I really do think that's important. In my opinion, you're isolating this one finding about the children's silence and not really confronting the record as a whole. So would you go forward, please?
Yes, Your Honor. The reason why I'm isolating this, Your Honor, is because that was really what the finding brought up. And that was the conclusion that was led based on this finding. Yes, there are plenty of findings about the instances of abuse or the interactions between the name calling and the potential harm that could happen. There is no dispute that that is being talked about, but I will note most of the findings themselves are not the court finding this to be true or this to happen. It's Ms. Rath testified to this. Ms. Oliver testified to this. The therapist testified to this, or an expert has stated this. There is no analysis of what that means or no decision of what that means. It's a recitation of what has been testified in a transcript or record. That in and of itself is not a finding in which a termination should happen. Specifically, on finding 80, page 10 of the order, Ms. Russell's testimony was credible and persuasive. She served as a trainer. The court goes in talking about what she does. And then earlier in there, it just says what Ms. Russell saw, what she testified to. There's no actual analysis of, based on her testimony, the court finds that the children have these ACEs, have these detrimental things happening to them, and they are directly because of father. And that is because there's no evidence in the record that the instance that the occasions and the videos that were produced showed that. And to the reason for that is because the videos themselves were not the whole picture of what was going on. The agency and the district court focused on the videos that are isolated incidents that weren't occurring every single day. They weren't being recorded every single day. They were specific instances that happened that one witness purposefully did to show the situation, but it did not show the situation as the whole. And I think that's the problem here is the district court valued these isolated videos, grouped them together and said, this is the whole picture. This must be what's occurring every single time. However, that isn't the case. And there is no evidence that was presented by the agency that this continued every single day.
Well, counsel, I guess I'd like to go back fairly quickly, though, and be clear that this record does include instances beyond the recorded instances of physical, emotional, verbal abuse by father of the children that go well beyond the recorded instances in January and February of 2021. And, you know, the record includes reports from 2016, includes reports from 2018 that came to the attention of the county. In fact, in 2018, the county opened an assessment and began to recommend services and the family refused. Services. And then we came forward to 2021. And I think the current set of instances. So, and all the district court does cover in its findings of fact, it includes, you know, this history of physical, emotional, and verbal abuse by father of the children. So I guess I'm struggling again with your perspective on the record here. I think it's much more significant than what you've described as isolated instances.
I think there is a little highlighting of 2016 and 2018 incidents, or I don't even call them incidents, that were brought to the attention of the agency, Your Honor. However, those instances that got brought to the attention, from my understanding, never became a full child in need of protection or services. The fact that a parent denied services does not equate that this issue happening.
You know, when you take each of those in line, I appreciate your point, but it's followed by in 2021, the district court receiving these recordings and summaries of the recordings in preliminary hearings and making a determination of egregious harm by this father on the children, such that the county was relieved of its duty to reunite and provide services. And I guess that brings me to a second significant point, and I want to understand your position on it because I was a little unsure after reading your brief. So the district court did relieve the county of its duties to provide services, which I didn't see a specific challenge, although kind of an indirect challenge in your appellate brief. And then the district court, and I think about a month later, did order the county to make an evaluation of whether some services would be helpful to father. And the social worker testified as to some services that would have been helpful to father, but the father failed to follow up. And the district court made that finding failed to follow up with any of the suggested services. And the district court made that finding. So I would just like to understand your take on that and whether you're challenging the district court's findings as to egregious harm so that the county was relieved of its duty, as well as the district court specific finding that father didn't follow up even with suggested services.
Regarding the egregious harm, Your Honor, due to the allegations of physical abuse as well as the video, it can't be said that egregious harm wouldn't probably have qualified. So it's not a specific challenge to that. I do dispute the relief of services. However, because prior counsel did not really challenge it at the lower court level, at this point, I would not have been allowed really to challenge it because it wasn't challenged, from my understanding, in the record.
Well, counsel, there is a pretrial order by the district court that indicates that the district court would consider the appropriateness of services as an issue at trial. My take on it, reading the district court's then subsequent trial order, is that when services were suggested to father, father did not follow up. So it really became a moot point because of father's failure to follow up. So, help me out there. Was there any evidence offered that father followed up with services?
No,
district court found no.
No, Your Honor, there was no evidence brought up that about services, and that leads to the ineffective assistance of counsel. There was no, and I see my time is up. May I finish my answer?
You may. Yeah. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal too. Please remember that.
Thank you. The issue was that no evidence was presented for, which is a twofold problem. First, ineffective assistance of counsel. The second is technically my client father is not required to prove that he has done services or is required to show anything. The point of a termination in those three factors is to weigh those options. Later in the decision to request services or what services may be offered is a little different than offering those services and whether or not father has availed himself to them. There is not really much in the record that explains if father did it, more besides, I believe Ms. Rath, who's the social worker testifying, she didn't have evidence that it happened. So she didn't actually know whether it did or didn't happen. And there was nothing in the record to indicate either way. So that finding doesn't seem very proper because there isn't.
I'll just ask you to, set aside the remainder of your comments until rebuttal.
Can I ask a question, Judge Broadfield?
Please go ahead.
And it is going to extend the time a little bit, but I have a couple of questions on this ineffective assistance of counsel. And I realize time is up, but if I could have just a minute or two. Counsel, is it true that at the time the TPR case was tried, your client was still under criminal charges it was a third degree assault, and that was resolved sometime later? Is that true?
That is, from my understanding, true, Your Honor. I think there was a plea deal that was made after the fact.
Right. It looked to me like, there isn't much in this record on this, but it looked like he pleaded guilty to a lesser offense or count two or something in the fall, in like September or October, and then was sentenced on that case. It seems like, and I know we have a limited record because of the issues you've already discussed, but I understand why, if that's true, counsel would not have wanted to put your client on the stand to testify, because he's going to either testify the things that could be admissible against him in the criminal case, or he's going to take the Fifth Amendment in the civil case, which could be, there could be an inference from that would be adverse to him in this case. So it seems like it would have been a grave error in judgment for trial counsel to have produced some of the evidence that isn't in the record.
I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor. It doesn't require my client to take the stand to be able to present evidence of relationship or, frankly, to present evidence that father may have sought services or sought recommendations or what he did. That could have been done by talking to a therapist, by working with other people who have seen him with his children and how he interacts with them on a different basis, not in that day presenting medical evidence.
Should we presume in the absence of those witnesses that there would have been witnesses who would have been favorable to him? That's my concern. I can't say that I don't believe there would be such witnesses, but we don't have anything in the record to suggest there are such witnesses.
And that's the problem. That's where ineffective assistance of counsel comes in, because there were witnesses and they didn't get presented. And it doesn't seem to be by trial strategy. It seems to be by lack of research into potential defenses.
How do we know that on this record?
I think we know that by the fact that the district court makes findings that because father did not produce evidence, therefore, he did not want to have a relationship. While I think that is a faulty premise on two fronts, on the front that he is not required to show the relationship, it is the analysis of the district court and the agency's burden to weigh all three options. The fact that the court faults father for that is something that, as a skilled attorney in termination proceedings, which father's counsel was, she is a court appointed attorney, it would have been something that made sense to present anything or even present some cross-examination if the counsel wasn't going to present witnesses on the lack of evidence that father didn't want a relationship or that father couldn't do treatment. There just wasn't anything there. And that's what is the problem. And that's why I think the record is very bare on most of these issues.
I can leave it at that and maybe come back to it on rebuttal. Thank you for the additional time, Judge Bradpool.
All right, counsel for respondent, we have reset the clock and we are ready for you when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Jill Jensen and I represent the respondent, Brown County Human Services. Your honors, this case, the standard by which you should look at it is whether the findings of fact are supported by substantial evidence and whether the findings of fact support the conclusions of law as to the children's best interest factors and palpable unfitness. Appellant is essentially requesting that this court reweigh the evidence and question the district court's credibility of witnesses and evidence, which is not this court's role. All of the findings that were made by the court were supported by substantial evidence. And I would point to several findings in the district court's order that were not mere recitations of evidence. For example, on page 13, the district court found in its conclusions that father has engaged in violence against household members since at least 2016, and he has engaged in psychological maltreatment of all the children. That is a finding of the district court, not a recitation of evidence, and it is supported by the record. Similarly, with respect to palpable unfitness, first I would point out that the district court need not address this, since appellant has agreed or conceded that other bases for termination of parental rights occurred or were proven, such as egregious harm and failure to continuously provide for the children's needs. However, if this court does address it, there is substantial evidence in the record and to support the district court's conclusion that appellant is palpably unfit. There was significant expert testimony, which the district court found credible to support its findings on adverse childhood experiences and psychological maltreatment, as well as the short and long-term effects of both of these occurrences.
So counsel, I'll just give you briefly one view of appellant's brief. You're right that the pitch to the arguments is primarily to challenge the basis for termination as to palpable unfitness, but the arguments that are raised are more general than that and arguably touch on all three of the statutory grounds for termination. And I'll just give you one example. So, and you're already right there and alluding to it. So I'll let you go forward. So one is that there is no connection or evidence connecting father to the PTSD that has been suffered by these three children. So, and you've already alluded to the expert testimony on that. And if you would explain that further, how, your view of the record and how it supports the district court's finding that the children's PTSD, which I think you'll agree with me, the PTSD would be, the children's PTSD would be relevant. And it, you know, it is certainly central to all three of the grounds, statutory grounds for termination, I think.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. First, though, I would note that I think the failure to specifically contest the egregious harm ground and the other statutory ground, including failure to cite that ground and explicitly analyze its requirements, I think that is a concession or.
And we certainly, you know, counsel, we could find forfeiture. That's certainly possible. Well, I wouldn't laugh. I mean, it is certainly a possibility. It's not necessarily what's going to happen in light of the other arguments that are made by appellants. So I think for the purposes of this argument, it would be helpful for us to hear what you, how you would respond to the arguments that are made by appellants. So for instance, that yes, these children suffer from PTSD, that's very clearly in the district court's findings, but where is the evidence that connects that to father's conduct? And I think you have it, I just am asking you to explain it.
Yes, Your Honor, and my apologies. If you turn to page 113 of the transcript, there is a testimony from the social worker that that AT and ET have PTSD and they are having ongoing therapy to work through those traumatic experiences. She then explains that they are not recommended to have visitation with appellant, and she's asked why that is. And the social worker states that that is because of the traumatic experience with appellant. And so for those reasons, I
believe. To be clear, this is not just a question of the therapist finding that each of the children has been physically abused by father, although that is included, I think, but that they have been in the presence of repeated physical abuse by father of multiple, you know, virtually every member of this family. Isn't that right?
Yes, Your Honor. You can hear in the recordings that some of the children are present. For example, ST is present when ET is being physically abused. DT is present when appellant is using very obscene language toward SM. And all of the children, with the exception of DT, were present and observed domestic violence back in 2016. And the expert explains why observation, as well as firsthand experience, adversely affects a child and would constitute an adverse childhood experience and would also contribute toward psychological maltreatment. So I think there's adequate support in the record based on the recordings, based upon the expert testimony, based upon the social worker's testimony that the PTSD diagnosis and the therapy is to address the traumatic experiences with father, for the district court to conclude the PTSD is resultant from appellant's conduct. So I do believe there is a causal connection in the record there, and that would go to the palpable unfitness as well as the egregious harm and failure to continuously provide for the children's needs.
So, counsel, how do you respond to appellant's argument about ineffective assistance of counsel? I mean, it is certainly true that post-trial motions would be the normal way and the best way to present a record. We don't have that here, and we won't have that here in light of the findings that have been made about the father's not being provided with notice, and you know, the discharge of trial counsel. I mean, I don't want to go through all those facts, but I do want you to respond to how we assess ineffective assistance of counsel in this case.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I would point out that there's really only a procedural irregularity with withdrawal of counsel and the what I would agree was not the correct notice that should have been sent. There's never been a finding or any sort of evidence presented to this court or the district court that his trial counsel did not inform him of his trial, post-trial rights and appellate rights. There's no evidence to support that in the record. Appellant could have made a post-trial motion, although I agree it would be outside the 10-day period, or apparently would it be outside the 10-day period. We simply don't know. He could have submitted an affidavit. They could have appealed the denial of that post-trial motion, and we would have ended up likely in the same place. Regardless, I don't think it would be appropriate without some sort of affidavit by father or to presume that trial counsel failed to inform him of his rights, especially given that there is a strong presumption that counsel is effective. I don't think the district court's order to allow counsel to withdraw and the faulty notice can be attributed to the trial counsel, but rather what was issued. And the only two issues that have been raised by respondent, well, the first would be that evidence was needed to rebut a presumption of palpable unfitness. First, there was no presumption of palpable unfitness to rebut. It was completely on the county to present clear and convincing evidence. And I would note, I'm jumping a little off track here, but appellant points to the three requisite findings regarding the children's best interest, whether the children have an interest in the relationship, whether father has an interest. And I agree that father does not have a burden to present any evidence that he has an interest in the parent-child relationship. However, I also don't have a burden to prove that he has an interest in the parent-child relationship. And the district court made findings, not simply that the children were silent, but that they do love father, and there would be trauma in terminating parental rights. And I think that was overlooked in appellant's brief as well, that the district court did acknowledge and weigh the children's interests, as well as there was some evidence in the record that father wanted visits with the children. So I would also point out that simply stating that father did not present evidence establishing that he wanted a relationship with children, the district court never said, therefore, he doesn't want a relationship with the children. I understand that that's appellant's argument, but I think that that statement is ambiguous. And moreover, that was not the only component of what is the parent's interest in the relationship. The district court also looked at father's conduct with the children and how the conduct presumably would have outweighed any interest. So that kind of goes back to the ineffective assistance counsel argument, in that even if counsel was ineffective, even if he was able to overcome this strong presumption that she was effective, it's not reasonably likely the result of the proceeding would have been different, because the district court considered the three bases. It found that the evidence or the children's competing interests very specifically outweighed any of those interests. And that is supported by the guardian ad litem's testimony, the social worker's testimony, and the expert witness's testimony.
Although it's not mentioned in the briefing, I'm looking at Rule of Civil Appellate Procedure 110.05. If anything material to either party is omitted from the record by error or accident, either before or after the record is transmitted to the appellate court, on motion by a party or on its own initiative, may direct that the omission or misstatement be corrected. So it seems like maybe this situation would fit within what the Court of Appeals may do on its own initiative by saying an error resulted in omission from the record of the testimony of trial counsel, for example. Isn't that an option that we might consider? That would be to afford Ms. Olson's client the opportunity by remanding to supplement the record on the court's own initiative.
And I apologize, Judge. Could you direct me again to the Rule of Civil Appellate Procedure? Did you say 105?
110.05. It doesn't look like the rule specifically talks about this sort of situation, but it occurs to me that maybe that rule would be broad enough to allow the court on its own initiative to say, we need a better record, and you're going to have a chance to make a better record.
I apologize. I'm just reading quickly.
Right. And I recognize it hasn't been mentioned by either of counsel. And so I'm sort of on my own initiative, finding the rule and saying, can we stretch it that far?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Appellant could have submitted an affidavit and motion in the district court, and that still would have been part of the record, even if the district court denied it.
Well, maybe he could have, because there was another error that compounded that, which is that his lawyer withdrew and may not have informed him of his right to make a motion for new trial or to supplement the record.
I would also point out, we don't know if the attorney withdrew. She was merely given permission to withdraw. So I understand what you're stating, but I think the appellant could have rectified this prior to bringing it to the Court of Appeals. And essentially what their argument is, we don't know, could have been ineffective. But what the record actually shows is very effective counsel. She did extensively cross-examine. She cross-examined mom, for example, on information she could not have known had she not conducted a thorough investigation. And that's really the only other thing appellant is claiming, is that she didn't conduct a thorough investigation and present a defense. Well, then how could counsel have known that mother is currently dating someone with a domestic violence record, or known to ask questions about her other non-joint child being given beer? Those are simply things that she would not have known had she not made an investigation. And I don't think this court should presume there's a possibility of ineffective assistance of counsel merely because of a procedural irregularity, and given appellant's, or the strong presumption that appellant's trial counsel was effective and absent any evidence in the record that she wasn't. For example, it appeared to me that her trial strategy was that the county could not prove its burden to meet the statutory grounds, and therefore there would not need to be evidence presented on best interests of the children, for example.
By the way, do you agree factually that at the time the TPR case was tried, counsel for appellant agrees, do you also agree that at the time the TPR case was tried, appellant was facing felony criminal charges that had not yet been resolved?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
If I may just have...
You may sum up. Go right ahead.
I was essentially just going to ask that the Court of Appeals affirm this case based upon the arguments in my brief and here today.
Thank you, Kent. So we're going to reset the clock for 5 minutes for rebuttal. There it is. So, counsel for appellant, you can begin your rebuttal when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. While listening to respondent's argument, I was reviewing the order, and a majority of the findings that are presented by the district court are someone testified to something. The recording shows this. There is nothing in there that creates an analysis of, because of those instances of findings, therefore father should have his rights terminated. Again, there is no dispute that father has said inappropriate things to the children. He said inappropriate things to the non-joint children, that there had been incidents, but there is nothing in here in that order that specifically states, because father said these things, therefore PTSD has occurred and that the children cannot continue their relationship with their father, or that services would not have been a better alternative.
Counsel, I just direct your attention to, you know, the addendum at page 12. So these are the district court's analysis and the conclusions of law at 7 of egregious harm. And there are specific findings of fact related to father, his conduct with the three children for whom his rights were terminated, as well as the conduct in these children's presence of the two older, the abuse against the two older children. And so, and a determination that that was egregious harm and it was a pattern of conduct by father. So I'm just not sure I'm following your last argument.
Your Honor, I would note that the conclusions of law are not necessarily supported by the actual findings. I think conclusions of law are summaries of what findings can be, but the findings themselves don't explain any thorough analysis of it, saying someone testified to something and that equates to that must mean this, doesn't do that. It doesn't give a proper analysis in the first part of the findings why this finding therefore creates this conclusion. And that's why you have that standard that you have to, the conclusions of law must be supported by the findings, and then those conclusions of law must then create the order. That's why you have it. But to
be
say,
fair to the district judge, though, Ms. Olson, a lot of the, I agree there are a number of findings of fact that say someone testified, but there's an important addition to that. What the district court found in most of those cases was this witness credibly testified that something, which seems it's awfully close to saying, I believe that person and therefore find it to be true.
I don't disagree that the court found people to be credible, and that's fine. But finding someone credible does not create a finding of that the conclusion that was made. And I would point out Ms. Russell, who is the expert. Ms. Russell doesn't specifically say that the children have these ACEs. She doesn't specifically ever make a conclusion in her testimony of which specific ACEs that father has contributed to the ACEs, and that because of this, father should not have his rights. Yet that is what the conclusion comes from. There's a lot of spots where she testifies to things, but it doesn't actually specifically say regarding these children. And in fact, it's noted that Ms. Russell said she couldn't. She couldn't make that determination because she didn't have enough evidence. Yet somehow that finding has turned into supporting a conclusion. And it's not there. It doesn't get supported by the record itself. The same with Ms. Rath. Ms. Rath, the social worker, testifies that that she has training in this and that a university expert explained some trauma-based things, and that's kind of it. The problem is it cuts off. It doesn't finish and conclude its theory. And that, I agree, could create a remand issue. And frankly, that would be beneficial. My client is asking to be able to present further findings, which again, Your Honor, 110.05, I agree, could allow the district court the Court of Appeals to say to the district court, allow him to present this evidence, because I don't think the findings, while there are numerous, are clear enough to create the conclusions that are there. I specifically note 65 on page 8. ACEs was described by Ms. Russell as maltreatment trauma, the effect of short trauma.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding your argument, but it sounds like you're now asking for an opportunity for an evidentiary hearing where the father would offer additional evidence as to the three statutory grounds for termination. Is that right? Because I thought we were talking about a record as to ineffective assistance of counsel. I mean, which I realize
that my question was intended to address.
Yeah. I see I'm out of time, Your Honor. So may
you can answer the question. Go ahead.
Thank you. What I'm saying is we don't have a clear enough record. 110.05, I agree, is regarding the attorney and creating that record. However, this court can reverse and remand also for the fact that there aren't clear enough distinctions or enough record to show that the three factors have been have enough analysis to provide it. Because my concern with the record and the order is that there's a lot of things that people testify to, but there's not any real determination of because of those findings that created the conclusion that was made. It is a lot of information, but it's not information that has enough thorough analysis to determine that father should have his rights terminated and that it was appropriate. And that's why we're asking for a reversal, because this is not fair to the children, and it's not fair to father as well. He wants to be a dad, and he should be allowed that opportunity. Thank you.
Is there anything else from the panel? Okay. So thank you, counsel, both lawyers in this case. We very much appreciate hearing from you.